This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Darwin's House of Cards, A Journalist's Odyssey Through the Darwin Debates by Tom Bethel. This book is read by Matthew McAuliffe. To Donna. Introduction. Doubts about evolution first arose in my mind when I looked at the title page of The Origin of Species. I read and then reread that page. On the Origin of Species, by means of natural selection, or the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life, by Charles Darwin, M.A., 1859. The words preservation and favored stood out. Was there any way of knowing what races, meaning species or individual variants, were favored other than by looking to see which ones were in fact preserved? Can favored be distinguished from preserved? It was in 1960 that my doubts arose. There was a lot of publicity about Darwin's theory at the time, and especially at Oxford University. Exactly 100 years earlier, Thomas Henry Huxley and Bishop Samuel Wilberforce had engaged in a famous debate at the university's Museum of Natural History. Twice a week, en route to tutorials at the psychology department, I would walk past that museum on Parks Road. Psychology, philosophy, and physiology was my major, although we didn't use that word. Psychology aims to study the mind, but the intractable problem was, and remains, that you can't see the mind from the outside. You can only experience it from within. And that means you can't touch it or measure it. As they said at the time, the mind is a black box. By the mid-20th century, psychology was worshiping at the feet of science, and observing and measuring are fundamental aspects of science. So an obvious question arose. Could science penetrate the black box of the mind? In an attempt to circumvent it, a discipline called behaviorism had been established by John B. Watson. He, in turn, was influenced by Ivan Pavlov. The goal was to reduce psychology to behavior, thereby sidestepping the black box problem. Responses, outputs, would be compared to stimuli, inputs. As long as a predictable relationship could be established between the two, the mind and consciousness could be quietly ignored and even, as far as science was concerned, assumed not to exist. Thought was assumed to be covert speech. Both behaviorism and neo-Darwinism derived their inspiration from the same zeitgeist of reductionist philosophy which prevailed during the first half of our 20th century, Arthur Koestler wrote. He characterized the conventional wisdom of that time as the belief that biological evolution was nothing but random mutations preserved by natural selection. It remains the conventional wisdom to this day. Experimental psychology could also study the brain directly, assuming it to be the mind's location. So researchers began dipping into the brain with electrodes. Today that field is called neuroscience. Meanwhile, the mind remains as intangible as ever. A part of the brain lighting up is one thing, and the individual sensation of blue is another. In fact, they are incommensurable things. Survival of the fittest. As to natural selection's preservation of the favored races, Herbert Spencer, a prominent figure in his day, said that Darwin's mechanism could be summarized as the survival of the fittest. Darwin was not impressed by Spencer, but he gratefully accepted his survival of the fittest formula and incorporated it into the fifth edition of The Origin of Species. So the question remains, is there any way of deciding what is fit other than by seeing what survives? If not, maybe Darwin was arguing in a self-confirming circle, the survival of the survivors. One day I mentioned the problem to my philosophy tutor, E.J. Lemon, who had studied under Alfred Tarski. Esteemed for his clarity, Dr. Lemon gave weekly lectures in the Schools building on Oxford's High Street. The vast hall would be packed with undergraduates hoping to get through their logic prelims. Lemon saw that the meaning of fitness was something that the leading field of Oxford philosophy, the ordinary language school dominated by John L. Austin, might find interesting. Can we describe the fitness of an organism or of one of its traits without waiting to see what survives and what doesn't? It was not a question that Dr. Lemon had been thinking about, but he allowed that it was worth considering. A few years later, he was hired away by Claremont Graduate School in California. Despite a weak heart, he climbed a hillside and was felled by a heart attack right there. He can't have been more than 40 years old. An austere volume, Beginning Logic, has survived him. When I look at its bleak truth tables, I feel that it doesn't do justice to the man. I had arrived at Oxford, naively imagining that philosophy taught us the meaning of life. I went to public lectures by Gilbert Ryle, whose book, The Concept of Mind, was then in fashion. It was plainly written, but like the psychologists of the day, Ryle aimed to reduce mind to behavior. I even attended a seminar by A.J. Ayer until I realized that I didn't understand half of what was said, not least by his voluble graduate students. In 1936, at the age of 26, Freddie Ayer had written Language, Truth, and Logic, declaring most philosophical problems to be meaningless, especially the ones that undergraduates were likely to find interesting. Late in life, he died in 1989, Ayer had a near-death experience. A resolute non-believer, he nonetheless wrote an article titled, What I Saw When I Was Dead. He told his attending physician, I saw a divine being. I'm afraid I'm going to have to revise all my books and opinions. Later, he said, the experience had weakened not my belief that there is no life after death, but my inflexible attitude towards that belief. Oxford philosophy was in some ways, intentionally, disillusioning, but later I came to see its usefulness. Many problems in philosophy had flourished over the years because the words formulating them often had no clear meaning. Philosophers had sometimes even indulged that imprecision. Fitness, at any rate, seemed worth analyzing, especially if its vagueness had misled biologists into believing that a mechanism of evolution had been discovered. Maybe they had only discovered that saying the same thing in two different ways could be so construed. The 1860 encounter between Huxley and Bishop Wilberforce was seen as a debate between religion and science. It was the first time, but far from the last, that Darwinism would generate such a conflict. Over the next 150 years, science and religion were routinely portrayed as antagonists, as they still are today. But it is a modern conceit. A counterclaim was persuasively made by Cambridge University's James Hannam in The Genesis of Science, 2010. Medieval Christianity actually laid the groundwork for the blossoming of science, Hannam argued. Newton, Faraday, and Clerk Maxwell, to name just three, embraced religion even as they advanced science. Nonetheless, the religion versus science stereotype did arise after Darwin's The Origin of Species and in consequence of it. In 1925, it was reinforced in America when John Scopes was indicted for teaching evolution in defiance of a Tennessee statute. The trial was a media circus, perhaps one of the first. Clarence Darrow derided William Jennings Bryan's fundamentalism, and scientific questions about Darwinism hardly arose. Ridicule carried the day. To this day, those who question Darwinism are sometimes still suspected of hostility to reason. At any rate, the validity of evolution as science is the key question to be addressed in this book. I hope to do so with minimal regard to religion. Stephen Jay Gould once wrote that the magisteria of science and religion don't overlap. Nonetheless, keeping them separate has never been easy. The main reason is that Darwin's supporters are eager to blur the distinction. Often, they resemble inquisitors, hunting for a heretical motive whenever criticism of evolution is raised. Darwin himself frequently argued his case in The Origin of Species by favorably contrasting his theory of descent with modification with the old story of independent creation. The former, obviously, was more plausible to him. Nonetheless, we plainly see evidence of design in complex, self-reproducing organisms. But Darwin and his modern disciples have insisted that that is a delusion. I question whether it really is, and discuss the intelligent design movement in a later chapter. In his correspondence, often less inhibited than his books, Darwin was disposed to give theological reasons for rejecting the evidence of design. "There seems to me too much misery in the world," he wrote to Asa Gray in 1860. "I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the ichneumonidae, digger wasps, with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that a cat should play with mice." After I graduated from Oxford, the evolution question faded from my mind. It wasn't revived until 10 years later. Then, in America, I came across a surprising book, Darwin Retried, 1973. Its author, Norman Macbeth, was a Harvard-trained lawyer. We may think of him as the forerunner to Philip Johnson, the law professor at UC Berkeley who did so much to launch the intelligent design movement. Macbeth's book carried impressive endorsements by Jacques Barzun, Arthur Kessler, and Karl Popper. "I regard the book as most meritorious and as a really important contribution to the debate," Popper wrote. A philosopher who was taken seriously at Oxford, Popper argued that to be certified as scientific, theories must, in principle, be falsifiable. It must be possible to devise experiments that can put such theories to the test, maybe corroborating them, or more critically, showing them to be false. Was that possible with Darwin's theory? Popper's criterion has since been challenged, but his principle of falsification is sound. True, a theory that is sufficiently hedged and qualified can be protected against all opposition. But hedged theories make for poor science, and when the Popperian test is weakened, so are the claims of hedged theories. Macbeth's book cited such pillars of Darwinian orthodoxy as Ernst Mayr, George Gaylord Simpson, and Sir Julian Huxley, grandson of T.H. I was delighted to see that one of the authorities cited by Macbeth, Conrad Waddington of Edinburgh University, confirmed my earlier doubts. A developmental biologist and a member of the small group of evolutionists who had shaped what became known as the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, Waddington said in 1959, "Darwin's major contribution was the suggestion that evolution can be explained by the natural selection of random variations. Natural selection, which was at first considered as though it were a hypothesis that was in need of experimental or observational confirmation, turned out on closer inspection to be a tautology, a statement of an inevitable, although previously unrecognized, relation. It states that the fittest individuals in a population, defined as those that leave most offspring, will leave most offspring. Once the statement is made, its truth is apparent." Norman Macbeth and I soon became friends, and we discussed this and many other things. He lived near Manhattan, and he introduced me to biologists and curators at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. I would learn that they had much more to say on related topics. I also had lengthy discussions with Colin Patterson, Gary Nelson, an expert on fossil fishes, and Norman Platnick, an expert on spiders. In his autobiography, Karl Popper said he had come to the conclusion that Darwinism is not a testable scientific theory, but a metaphysical research program. To say that a species now living is adapted to its environment is almost tautological, he wrote. "Adaptation, or fitness, is defined by modern evolutionists as survival value, and can be measured by actual success in survival. There is hardly any possibility of testing a theory as feeble as this." Further controversy ensued, for Popper, apparently under pressure in England, partially recanted in 1978. Later in 1988, I had a chance to interview Popper myself when he spent a week at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. I immediately brought up the issue of natural selection. He told me that his opinion had not changed. He also said he thought that natural selection had, in fact, been falsified by Darwin's own theory. Distortions introduced by sexual selection sometimes meant that offspring were not better adapted than their parents, he said. When I mentioned that Darwinism had evidently benefited from the idea of progress, widely accepted in the mid-19th century, but widely rejected in the late 20th, Popper said that, "I have been one of the people who have destroyed it." He said he had preached along those lines in his book, The Poverty of Historicism. Popper's comment that Darwin's theory is feeble is certainly true, and Darwinism can also be viewed as a research program. But it's not clear that natural selection can ever be falsified in any particular context. See my chapter 5. Suffice it to say that evolutionists cling to natural selection and have done so tenaciously ever since Darwin. It is the main mechanism of biological improvement, or progression from molecules to man, that has been attributed to the undirected or random operations of the natural world. Both Popper and Kessler suggested that Darwinism was a child of its time, inspired more by the Zeitgeist than by science strictly construed. What about today? In his posthumously published book, The Discarded Image, 1964, C.S. Lewis argued that the scientific facts that seem important in one age may be seen quite differently in another, or may be ignored altogether. The question whether our time is significantly different from Darwin's is an important one, and I discuss it in my first chapter. Chapter 1. Darwinism in Our Time. In 1949, C.S. Lewis wrote to a friend that evolution, etc., was the assumed background of modern thought. Then, in The Discarded Image, he argued that a developing world, by which he meant an evolving one, was obviously in harmony with the revolutionary and the romantic temper. He was specifically thinking of Darwin's theory. As history unfolds, he continued, later generations are likely to look for a new model or worldview. That search may well precede any evidence pointing to or requiring such a transformation. But when the desire for a new outlook matures, scientists go to work and discover the evidence. Nature, Lewis went on, has all sorts of phenomena in stock and can suit many different tastes. In short, the model of a particular time reflects the prevalent psychology of an age almost as much as it reflects the state of that age's knowledge. The worldview of Lewis's day was likely to change sooner or later, and we seem to be in such a transition period today, and perhaps have been for a decade or longer. Three or four such changes are worth noting. The first, and perhaps most important, is the loss of the idea of progress. Throughout, progress is capitalized to denote the philosophy as it existed in Darwin's day. See chapter 21. In Darwin's day, progress was thought of as an all-embracing fact. In his autobiography, Darwin said that man in the distant future will be a far more perfect creature than he now is. He also said at the end of The Origin of Species that all corporeal and mental endowments will tend to progress toward perfection. Few believe anything like that today. The word evolution does not occur once in The Origin. Evolved appears once. It is the last word in the book. Instead, Darwin referred to improvement, which does convey the idea of progress. Either improved or improvement appears dozens of times. Victorian philosophers, Darwin among them, were immersed in the idea of progress. They were, Lewis wrote, favored members of the happiest class in the happiest country in the world at the world's happiest period. They took progress for granted. One only has to read statements by our environmentalists to see how much things have changed. Mankind today is seen as the ruination of the planet. The alleged extinction of recent or contemporary species is blamed on human carelessness, while climate change, assumed to be anthropogenic, has become a major cause. Supposed remedies take precedence over such mundane matters as economic growth and the well-being of the poor. They are embraced by the ruling class all over Europe and the Western world. The second change is demographic. Fertility rates have fallen below replacement level, right across the Western world. Food production widely outpaces population growth, and obesity exceeds hunger as a health risk. Thomas Robert Malthus would not have expected that. According to his calculations, population increased geometrically and was destined to outrun food supply. Furthermore, Darwin's theory of evolution was directly inspired by the Malthusian doctrine. The worldview underlying Darwinism conformed to the spirit of its age, that of the late Enlightenment. As long as the two were broadly aligned, Darwin's philosophy was accepted by most scientists, and therefore by most educated laymen. Articles in academic journals were waved through the familiar checkpoints. Peer review, for example, is sometimes used as a barrier to entry for non-approved science. Within the academic world, dissenters from Darwinism could be expelled. As for biology departments, no dissent is permitted for untenured faculty. Creationist has become the accusation of choice against dissenters, while authoritarianism or scientism is frequently substituted for science. Nonetheless, we are seeing a tide that is slowly turning. Faith in evolutionism, and it is a faith, has declined along with the new hostility to progress. That is to be expected because a progressive philosophy was built into Darwinism from the beginning. At the same time, large holes have begun to appear in the science. The intelligent design movement, which rose to prominence in the 1990s and was promptly dismissed by the academy, has flourished. The philosopher and mathematician William A. Dembski, one of the founders of the movement, said recently that it has grown internationally and has pressed Western intellectuals to take seriously the claim that life and the cosmos are the product of intelligence. To be sure, many of them reject this claim, but their need to confront and refute it suggests that our mental environment is no longer stagnating in the atheistic materialism that for so long has dominated Western intellectual life. With atheistic materialism now itself in question, Christianity is again on the table for discussion. As an additional change, one might also mention the digital revolution, and with it the Internet. It is comparable in magnitude to the change wrought by the printing press in the 15th century. What the long-term effect of the digital revolution will be, no one can foresee. But it is decentralizing the flow of information, and, to the previously marginalized, the cost of information has been greatly reduced. One might say that the flow of information is being democratized. In particular, criticism of Darwin's theory of evolution now reaches many more people than it did when journals like Science and Nature were able to dominate science news. For a decade or two, Darwinism's promoters and beneficiaries, most of them lodged within universities, will pretend that nothing much is happening. But the auguries are not good. Those who claim to live by science will eventually die by science. Historians thrive because it is difficult to know in detail what happened 100 years ago, let alone 1,000. Darwinists benefit from the great difficulty of knowing what happened 1 million years ago, not to mention 1 billion. They are pleased to think that because some skeptics reject their extrapolations and conclusions, they are opposed to science. But as I hope to show in the following chapters, the science of neo-Darwinism was poor all along, and supported by very few facts. I have become ever more convinced that, although Darwinism has been promoted as science, its unstated role has been to prop up a philosophy, the philosophy of materialism and atheism along with it. Darwin's House of Cards. Darwinism was once a well-fortified castle with elaborate towers, moats, and battlements. It remained in that condition for well over 100 years, from the publication of The Origin of Species in 1859 to the Darwin Centennial, and then for perhaps 3 decades after that. Today, however, it more closely resembles a house of cards, built out of flimsy icons rather than hard evidence, and liable to blow away in the slightest breeze. David Gelernter, who survived one of the Unabomber's mailed explosive devices, said in 2014, that attacking Darwin is the sin against the Holy Ghost that pious scientists are taught never to forgive. That is mostly still true today, but the times are changing. In November 2016, the Royal Society in London, one of the world's most eminent scientific societies, convened a group of scientists to discuss calls for revision of the standard theory of evolution, acknowledging that the issues involved remain hotly contested. The meeting itself appears to have been a dud, with nothing genuinely capable of rescuing the standard theory having been proposed. But the fact that the meeting was convened at all is telling. It offers hope that the issues to be discussed in the following chapters may yet receive a serious airing. Chapter 2. Darwin's Mistake. Warm Little Pond. Darwin's claim to fame was the discovery of natural selection, widely regarded as the mechanism of evolution. But before taking a closer look at that, we should consider the origin of life itself. How did that happen? In the second, 1860, edition of The Origin of Species, Darwin speculated, "Probably all the organic beings which have ever lived on this earth have descended from some one primordial form, into which life was first breathed by the Creator." First breathed by the Creator. The last three words, not present in the first edition of 1859, were perhaps a tactful concession toward the advocates of special creation, who were still dominant in 1860. In the same 1860 edition, Darwin made a similar addition to the end of the book. "There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one." Here he allowed that life might have been breathed into matter more than once by special actions of the Creator. But no such intellectual evasion was needed 12 years later when he wrote to his close friend and supporter, the botanist Joseph Hooker, "But if, and oh what a big if, we could conceive in some warm little pond, with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, light, heat, electricity, etc. present, that a protein compound was chemically formed, ready to undergo still more complex changes." Now he was hoping to find that life might have originated in a warm little pond. But in the ensuing 145 years, numerous attempts to generate life in test tubes have been made, and all have failed. The Miller-Urey experiments of 1953 produced mainly a simple amino acid, along with traces of some others, under conditions that did not match the early Earth environment it intended to replicate. No further progress has been made. The origin of life field is a failure. We still do not have even a plausible coherent model, let alone a validated scenario for the emergence of life on Earth, Eugene Koonin said in 2011. A Russian immigrant at the NIH and a senior investigator at the National Center for Biotechnology Information, Koonin also said that a succession of exceedingly unlikely steps is essential for the origin of life, making the final outcome seem almost like a miracle. Koonin also writes, "Scientists have also been unable to find life on Mars or anywhere else. The question how life began and why it seems to be unique here remains a conspicuous difficulty for the materialistic view of life." Life has this remarkable feature. Organisms can reproduce themselves. Darwin and just about everyone else took their self-reproducing capacity for granted. It does happen, obviously. Bacteria do it asexually. Cells in the body do it. But a big leap of faith was required to accept that the accidental collision of molecules, even given billions of years, could generate self-reproducing entities called cells. Bear in mind that natural selection can play no role at this stage, because it assumes the prior existence of self-reproducing entities. We also need to remind ourselves just how improbable such things are. No non-living thing has ever been able to reproduce itself without assistance from an intelligent, human agent. If it could be done, factory assembly lines might well become a thing of the past. As to natural selection, it also seems remarkable that the machinery of evolution should be built automatically into self-reproducing organisms. But that is what many of those with scientific aspirations came to believe after The Origin of Species was published. What do we really know about natural selection? To summarize the current view, as a source of innovation, mutations in the DNA molecule generate random variations. and natural selection then acts as a filtering device. Unfit variants rarely survive even the early stages of development. As a matter of observation, then, what we find when organisms reproduce is that descendants incorporate small changes. Offspring differ a little from their parents, and their offspring differ even more from their grandparents, and so on. So the reproduction that we see is imperfect. All die in the end, but some variant forms contrive to leave more offspring than others. Darwin was a materialist, and his theory was as materialistic as his philosophy. So he could not rely on anything beyond or outside the natural world, a designer, for example. In fact, The Origin deliberately set out to explain life in all its complexity without any appeal to a designer or creator. Darwin and his later supporters have assumed that in order to qualify as science, the study of nature must appeal exclusively to natural causes. Science and religion must be kept separate. Miracles are ruled out. Darwin wanted to establish that the study of nature had been updated, with no role allowed for design or the supernatural. Indeed, if his theory was true, no such designer was needed. A letter from Wallace. Darwin was conducting his own leisurely researches, first in London and then at his country house in Kent, when he heard from Alfred Russel Wallace, a naturalist who had spent time in the Malay archipelago. In 1858, he sent a letter to Darwin proposing a theory so similar to Darwin's as to be virtually identical. Wallace's ternate essay, entitled On the Tendency of Varieties to Depart Indefinitely from the Original Type, spurred the dawdling Darwin into action. His patient note-taking became The Origin of Species within a year. Coincidentally, both Darwin and Wallace had read Malthus's Essay on the Principle of Population, first published in 1798, and expanded in later editions. A free market economist, Malthus made the argument that population increases geometrically, while food supply grows only arithmetically. The former will rapidly outpace the latter, putting pressure on many organisms and causing many to die of starvation. Darwin found that Malthus, that great philosopher, had given him a theory with which to work. The doctrine of Malthus equally applied to the animal and vegetable kingdoms, where there could be no artificial increase of food and no prudential restraint from marriage, Darwin wrote. Without such restraint, the earth would soon be covered by the progeny of a single pair. Darwin sounded like a modern-day environmentalist in positing that there would one day literally not be standing room. In his autobiography, Darwin said that he first read Malthus in 1838. It at once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved, and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The result of this would be the formation of new species. Wallace said something very similar. Perhaps the most important book he had read, he said, was Malthus's Principle of Population. It eventually gave him the long-sought clue to the effective agent in the evolution of organic species. In short, both Darwin and Wallace read the same book and responded in the same way. Organisms would find themselves pressured by the Malthusian math, somehow causing them to increase in complexity and to speciate, thereby generating the fitter and then the fittest, allowing the fittest of all to survive. "How extremely stupid not to have thought of that," said Thomas Huxley when he first read Darwin's argument. The philosopher, Bertrand Russell, was a little more careful. Darwin's theory was essentially an extension to the animal and vegetable world of laissez-faire economics. Darwin relentlessly pursued his insight. Organisms live by the Malthusian struggle. Lighten the pressure, mitigate the destruction ever so little, and the number of the species will almost instantaneously increase to any amount. It was as though he thought of new species as waiting in the wings. All organisms had to do was to increase their rate of reproduction, and ever more species would appear on stage. At its heart, Darwin's theory was a theory of competition, with free market insights applied to struggling animals. As to Wallace's indefinite departure from the original type, it is the focal point of what I have called Darwin's mistake. Here is the problem in summary. We all know that small differences are observed between the generations. Offspring may be slightly smaller than the parents, or slightly larger, or different in many other ways. Darwin's mistake was to assume that these differences somehow accumulate over the millennia, so that one species eventually transforms itself into another. Without evidence, Darwin's supporters today still accept that intergenerational differences accumulate, eventually transforming their phenotype or bodily form. But such a transformation has never been observed. No species has ever been seen to evolve into another. What scientists do observe is something quite different: reversion to a mean. Such reversion can be analogized to commuting, or going back and forth. But Darwin's theory perceives intergenerational changes as something more resembling an incessant journey. In short, Darwin's mistake was one of extrapolation. Although extrapolation can be a legitimate procedure in scientific analysis, it is always a risky one, and if done without due care, can lead to erroneous conclusions. Wallace's biographer, the science historian Michael Flannery, has pointed out that later in life, Wallace changed his mind and embraced what is now called intelligent design. "To me," Flannery said in an interview, "the best source on this is the very title to his book, The World of Life, A Manifestation of Creative Power, Directive Mind, and Ultimate Purpose," 1910. In the book, Wallace cited examples of the evidence for design in the natural world. For example, he wrote, "Looking at it as a whole, the bird's wing seems to me to be, of all the mere mechanical organs of any living thing, that which most clearly implies the working out of a preconceived design in a new and apparently most complex and difficult manner, yet so as to produce a marvelously successful result." Today, Wallace's defection from Darwin's camp is usually either played down or widely ignored. Two questions. Early on, Darwin said that he would offer only general conclusions about the origin of species, that mystery of mysteries, but he would add a few facts in illustration. Publishing all the facts with references was something that he hoped to do in a future work, but that work was never written. The origin was merely his abstract. He rushed to complete it when he saw that Wallace had the same idea and might publish first. "The Malthusian forces are usually balanced," Darwin thought, "but a trifling event will give the victory to one organic being over another. What checks the tendency of a given species to increase? We don't know, even in a single instance," he allowed. This, too, he would discuss in his future work and at considerable length, although he never did. In The Origin, Darwin instead addressed two great questions. Given that offspring are imperfect copies of the parental generation, can natural selection, on its own, really bring about the transmutation from simple to complex forms, generating new species en route? To that question, Darwin's followers have consistently answered yes. Second, did such organisms form an unbroken parent-offspring chain throughout the history of life? This is the question of universal common descent. It boils down to this: did life emerge from non-life only once? Or could it have happened several, or many, times? Because time travel is impossible, it is difficult to answer the question. Other than by looking at fossils, or more recently, at DNA evidence. Even then, the evidence may not be able to resolve the question decisively. Both questions therefore pose a continuing challenge to Darwin's theory. His own study of domesticated animals provided Darwin with ideas and clues. He joined pigeon fancier clubs in London and marveled at their diversity. The carrier pigeon, the tumbler, the pouter, the trumpeter, the fantail. An ornithologist, if shown these specimens, might well see them as distinct and well-defined species. Meanwhile, we should recall that pigeons, whether specially bred or living in the wild, have never been observed to evolve into anything else. Pigeons, they have always remained. Darwin's claim was that, in the natural world, selection accumulated differences, just as human breeders accumulate them under domestication. Animal breeders had indeed shown that some hereditary modification is possible. Breeders knew how to cultivate certain traits, color, length of feather, or wool, for example, and often found that the offspring of selected mates had the desired character more abundantly, or more noticeably than its predecessors. So it could be said a small amount of evolution has occurred between one generation and the next. By analogy, then, Darwin argued that the same process arises in nature, only this time much more effectively. With a rhetorical flourish, he wrote in The Origin, "How fleeting are the wishes and efforts of man, how short his time, and consequently how poor will his products be compared with those accumulated by nature during whole geological periods. Can we wonder, then, that nature's productions should be far truer in character than man's productions, that they should be infinitely better adapted to the most complex conditions of life?" He was saying that whatever man could do, nature could do better. Just as human breeders selected those individuals best suited to their needs to be the progenitors of the next generation, so Darwin argued, nature selected those organisms that are best fitted to survive the ongoing struggle for existence. In that way, progressive change would persist. Darwin then claimed that nature's selection was as superior to man's feeble efforts as the works of nature are to those of art. But here he was speaking metaphorically, not appealing to evidence. So there it was. Improving machinery was built into nature, daily and hourly scrutinizing, Darwin wrote, silently and insensibly working at the improvement of each organic being. In this way, Darwin thought, one type of organism would inevitably be transformed into another. He went so far as to write in the first edition of The Origin that he could see no difficulty in bears becoming more and more aquatic in their structure and habits, with larger and larger mouths, till a creature was produced as monstrous as a whale. He abandoned his bears-to-whale speculation in later editions. "If feeble man can do much by his powers of artificial selection," he said, "he could see no limit to the beauty and infinite complexity of the co-adaptations between all organic beings." But he failed to point out that feeble man is able to select because he has a rational mind, whereas it has yet to be shown that nature has any such thing. Nature as agent. In Darwin's hands, natural selection resembled a magic wand. It was capable of doing whatever a creator could do. But his theory also introduced something else. The underlying mechanism was no longer supernatural. It had been turned into a naturalistic and scientific claim. It was pleasing to the 19th century for that reason, as it still is to the modern age more generally. Paul Nelson, a philosopher of science with Discovery Institute, points out that when Darwin made his arguments, he saw no need for proof. He said, in effect, "Tell me why these minor changes should not add up over time to major differences." Of course, asking why a particular thing should not happen evades the duty of a hypothesis to explain how it does happen. It was one of Darwin's favorite rhetorical devices, and he used it repeatedly in The Origin. For quite some time, Darwin's mechanism was not seriously examined. Then the renowned geneticist Thomas H. Morgan, winner of the Nobel Prize for his work in mapping the chromosomes of fruit flies, suggested that the whole thing looked suspiciously like a tautology. "For it may appear little more than a truism," he wrote, "to state that the individuals that are the best adapted to survive have a better chance of surviving than those not so well adapted to survive." Darwin often wrote as if nature were imbued with purpose. Just as breeders could magnify the differences between their varieties by careful selection of breeding stock, so nature itself selected varieties in the wild, eventually generating the species that we see. But can nature make choices in the same way that a farmer can when he is deciding which variants to select? That it could was one of the main arguments in The Origin. In response to Darwin, the philosopher Jerry Fooder, the author of What Darwin Got Wrong, with Massimo Piattelli-Palmarini, 2010, said that natural selection can't make decisions. Fooder also wrote that natural selection can't run experiments, and it can't consult the intentions of the builder. Doing any of those requires having a mind, and by general consensus, natural selection doesn't have one. All natural selection can do is respond to correlations between phenotypic traits and fitness, and that doesn't help because, by assumption, if either of the confounded traits is correlated with fitness, so too is the other. Fuder's point was that whole organisms leave offspring, and they include numerous traits that are inevitably conflated. So when they leave offspring, it is impossible to say which of the conflated traits has been selected for. Fuder's criticism has never been rebutted. Running wild. At one point, Darwin brought up an objection to his own theory. Naturalists claimed that domestic varieties, when set free and run wild, gradually but certainly revert in character to their aboriginal stocks. If so, no deductions can be drawn from domestic races to species in a state of nature. Here, in effect, Darwin himself was bringing up the extrapolation objection. But Darwin partly raised the issue himself. Many of the most strongly marked domestic varieties could not possibly live in a wild state, he allowed. Being conspicuous, they would be selected against. Reversion, as he called it, also implied that varieties don't stray far from a mean, or what Wallace called the original type. Unanswered, that criticism might revive the theory of archetypes as proposed by Darwin's contemporary and opponent, Richard Owen, who founded London's Natural History Museum. Darwin firmly rejected archetypes, the original pattern on which all things of the same kind are based, because they would set sharp limits to variation, and that would be fatal to his theory. That such limits to variation do exist was assumed by most authors, Darwin allowed, although he claimed not to know of a single fact on which their claim was based. But neither could he point to a single case of the unlimited variation that his theory required. All was based on his willingness to extrapolate from the small variations that we do routinely see between successive generations. In The Origin, Darwin gave one imaginary illustration of natural selection. He supposed a place where wolves are hard-pressed for food and prey is scarce. In that setting, he could see no reason to doubt that the swiftest and slimmest wolves would have the best chance of surviving and to be preserved or selected. But there is indeed a reason to doubt victory to the swiftest, as I shall argue in Chapter 5. In much the same way, he went on, man can improve the fleetness of his greyhounds by methodical selection, but the two cases are not remotely comparable. The selection of greyhounds by human breeders for speed is a purposive, goal-directed act, while the wolf case is not. In Chapter 6, I discuss the cases of natural selection that have actually been observed. Darwin also asked why, if species have descended from others by fine gradations, we don't see innumerable transitional forms. Furthermore, why are species so well-defined? Why is all nature not in confusion? These were good questions. He tried to answer them by saying that the same process that improved and transformed some varieties extinguished their predecessors. Both the parent and all the transitional varieties will generally have been exterminated by the very process of formation and perfection of the new form. So once again, his understanding of natural selection as an all-powerful force came to his rescue. It could account both for the appearance and the disappearance of intermediate forms, whichever was needed. Meanwhile, the intermediate forms that his theory required have remained mostly elusive to this day. Darwin said at one point that if any complex organ could be shown to exist which could not have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, then his theory would absolutely break down. But he could find no such case. True, an organ so perfect as the eye was enough to stagger anyone. But for any organ, if we know of a long series of gradations in complexity, each good for its possessor, then, under changing conditions of life, there is no logical impossibility in the acquirement of any conceivable degree of perfection through natural selection. Notice the weakness of his response. To say that perfection was not logically impossible for natural selection leaves unanswered the question, was it physically possible? In his book, Darwin's Black Box, Lehigh professor biochemist Michael Behe refuted Darwin's claim that complex organs could be formed by a long series of steps. See my chapter 14 for more on Behe's objection. What about instinctive behavior? Such acts are performed by young animals without any experience and without knowing their purpose. Darwin mentioned the precise honeycomb structures of bees and the even more complex edifices built by ants. Instincts, he argued, were similar to habits. They can be modified by the will or reason. Mozart performed at the age of 3, but even he had to practice. Similarly, it would be an error to suppose that instincts were acquired in a single generation. As Darwin saw, a degree of variation in instincts was indispensable for natural selection to apply. Everything had to appear in the step-by-step fashion that his theory decreed. In fact, he wrote, the canon, Natura non facit saltum, nature doesn't make jumps, is applicable to instincts as well as to corporeal structure. The problem for Darwin was that he knew of no cases of gradually acquired instincts. Instinctive behavior, therefore, really does seem to involve jumps without trial and error. Mozart indeed had to practice, but hive-making bees don't. Fossil record. Darwin candidly accepted that his theory predicted a finely graduated organic chain, which geology failed to show. It was the gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. Then he added a further complication. We should be looking for common ancestors, not intermediates between two forms. We don't expect to find intermediates between the horse and the tapir, for example. What we do expect are links between each and an unknown common parent. But that only magnified his problem. The number of intermediate and transitional links must have been inconceivably great. But assuredly, if this theory be true, such have lived upon this earth. Why then don't we see the intermediates that must have existed? Because new and improved varieties will inevitably supplant and exterminate the older, less improved, and intermediate varieties. So, species are rendered to a large extent defined and distinct objects. Here, perhaps surprisingly, he brought in the phenomenon of extinction to rescue his theory. He argued that species need environmental slots if they are to flourish. The number of places in the polity of nature is not indefinitely great, he said. The extinction of old species, therefore, opened up new spaces for new ones. To strengthen his case, Darwin said that only a small portion of the earth had been explored, so a poor fossil record was to be expected. Still, Darwin allowed, if we study a single formation, it is difficult to understand why we do not therein find closely graduated varieties between the allied species which lived at its commencement and at its close. More recent analyses of the fossil record have shown that it is more complete than most people realize. I discuss the issue in Chapter 10. When it came to classification, Darwin was a lumper, not a splitter. He concluded that there is no fundamental distinction between species and varieties. This worked greatly to his advantage, because mutation and natural selection can be shown to increase the number of varieties, but not to generate new species. To this day, such species transformations have not been demonstrated. They would be headline news if they had. He restated his faith in unlimited variation. The claim that it is limited was incapable of proof, he wrote, since we see both variation and a powerful agent always ready to act and select. Why should we doubt that more variation, in any way useful, would be preserved? He saw no limit to this power. Again, we find Darwin arguing not that his theory had been shown to be right, but that his opponents had failed to show that it was wrong. Darwin wrote that when The Origin was published, eminent naturalists had rejected his theory. Why so? Because they were convinced that species are immutable. Also, as Darwin saw it, we are slow to admit any great change when we do not see the intermediate steps. Yet to this day, species still do seem to be immutable, and the intermediate steps are still largely missing. In the following chapters, I shall look more closely at Darwin's various claims in the light both of new evidence against them and of the failure of Darwinians to unearth much in support of them. But first, in the next chapter, I shall briefly review the copiously documented Darwin Centennial held in Chicago in 1959 with Darwin's grandson, Sir Charles, in attendance. Darwinism probably reached its greatest level of support at about that time. Chapter 3. Darwin's Curia at the Centenary. Darwin's centenary proceedings, celebrated at the University of Chicago in 1959, give us a good picture of the conventional wisdom about Darwinism prevailing at that time. All the eminent evolutionists of the day were assembled in Chicago. Sir Julian Huxley, Ernst Mayr, Sewell Wright, George Gaylord Simpson, Louis Leakey, Theodosius Dobzhansky, Ledyard Stebbings, Herman J. Muller, E.B. Ford, and C.H. Waddington. In an inspired moment years later, the well-known Harvard naturalist Edward O. Wilson referred to them as Darwin's Curia. In 1959, the opinions of biblical fundamentalists on evolution were ignored. National polls, showing that only a minority outside the academic world actually believed in undirected evolution, had not yet been undertaken. The school of thought known as intelligent design did not exist. In short, Darwin's theory encountered few centennial challenges. Furthermore, earlier problems had been resolved. In the 1860s, an apparently fatal criticism of Darwinism had been raised by a Scottish engineer named Fleming Jenkin. Helpful variations, he thought, would inevitably be blended and diluted away by bad mutations in later generations. But Mendel's laws of inheritance, which Darwin had not known about, showed the criticism to be in error. Genes don't blend and are preserved from one generation to the next. Meanwhile, in an attempt to solve the non-problem that he faced, Darwin took refuge in Lamarckism, the inheritance of acquired characteristics. But that, in turn, was shown to have been an unnecessary move. Recently, the field called epigenetics may have shown that acquired characters can be transmitted to future generations. But such claims are controversial. I review them briefly in Chapter 14. In other ways, the post-Mendelian dispensation was highly accommodating toward Darwinism. Throughout the 20th century, but not in the 21st, genes could be invoked without being observed, and one or many genes could be thought of as contributing solely or jointly to any trait. Ronald A. Fisher, Sewell Wright, and other mathematically inclined population geneticists went to work and by the 1940s had cobbled together what seemed to be a satisfactory solution to all problems. The melding of natural selection and Mendelian genetics became known as the neo-Darwinian synthesis. At the centenary, other difficulties were minimized or ignored. The double helical structure of DNA, coiled within the nucleus of every cell, recently described by James Watson and Francis Crick, was seen as a solution to old problems rather than a source of new ones. In 1956, the chromosomes were reliably counted for the first time, 46 in the case of humans. But beyond that, the cell remained largely terra incognita. With the aid of powerful microscopes, it was felt the hidden things of this world would soon be brought to light, and any remaining doubts would be swept away. Such was the temper of the time. In the Chicago discussions, harmony usually displaced argument. At one point, Dobzhansky said, "I agree with both Mayr and Stebbins." Julian Huxley, "That's bad, we're all agreeing." Huxley to Wright, "I take it you entirely agree with Stebbins." Right. "I agree with everybody." In short, they presented a united front. But in a late interview with Skeptic, published in 2000, Ernst Mayr showed that that harmony was short-lived. At the age of 95, he was out of sorts and displeased with a number of his colleagues. For example, he said of George Gaylord Simpson, the author of The Major Features of Evolution, that he never really understood the species concept, because he didn't have a personal acquaintance with nature. Mayr also said that there are two kinds of scientists, media scientists and scientists' scientists. Stephen Jay Gould, Richard Dawkins, and E.O. Wilson were media scientists in the sense of publishing for the public. Wilson himself later called Dawkins a journalist. Sir Charles Darwin, 1887 to 1962, grandson of the great man, crossed the Atlantic.